suppose I'd better tell you about myself. My name is Roberts, Dr. Linda Roberts. I'm an anthropologist, a specialist in the science of man's development.
Tamba, this is Dr. Roberts. He came here to find out if you and I were first cousins. Doesn't seem to like the idea.
Nothing much he can do about it. Jim, you know what anthropology is. It's the study of man.
You want to use me for a guinea pig?
Not quite. But I can use your skill as a hunter and a guide. Jim, this jungle's a huge laboratory. There's so much I want to see and study.
So?
I want you to act as my guide.
After you tell me what you started to say before. Now, what is it you want me to help you find?
The land of the giant people.
The land of the giant people?
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you very much, Michael H. Price, without whom the whole Forgotten Horrors franchise would not exist. So we are off. Well, we really owe you and George Turner a debt of gratitude for all of what this has become. I doubt that you guys saw that was going to happen when you did the first one back in the 70s, right?
No, we figured that was the beginning and the end of it. Although off and on, I'd recommend a sequel, and George say, "Oh no, we got too many other things to do." And then right as we were completing the 20th anniversary edition of the first book in 1999, maybe we ought to do that sequel after all. So he then died unexpectedly. Right. But he did get a couple of chapters for Volume 2 done after he'd had that burst of inspiration.
And we should mention also that you've got a new book out about George that we want to talk about a little bit later on in the program.
Oh, yeah.
Just came out. But right now, let's turn our attention to Johnny Weissmuller and the Jungle Jim series, and which you have dealt with in the Forgotten Horrors books. This is a particularly weird one, though, and I had not seen a Jungle Jim like a lot of kids, like a lot of Monster Kid age people. I grew up on the Jungle Jim TV show after school, which
sure.
is pretty much like the movies. And I was not, when I revisited Jungle Jim all these years later, I was not quite ready for a number of things. First of all, I think the woodenness of Weissmuller was something I hadn't noticed before. He was just not, either he was just phoning it in or he was not, he didn't seem very engaged in this picture.
He was grateful to be working, and it was because he would have quit after Tarzan and the Mermaids,
right?
Because of the death of his stunt double.
Yes, yes.
That was in what 1948, I believe.
Late 40s, right? Yes.
Uh-huh. Right, and he was. He said that Tarzans had lost their charm for me, and I for them. He said. And good old Sam Katz went to the rescue, and he presented him a Jungle Jim franchise that played to his popular image, but required a whole lot less, shall we say, involvement.
Well, yes, and certainly physical involvement. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he just had to be there, and Johnny never pretended to be much of an actor.
Right, right.
He carried the Tarzans on muscularity and vigor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to do the kind of deadpan Tarzan dialogue for ironic effect.
And this is where, of course, Jungle Sam Katzman, the producer, gets his moniker of Jungle from Jungle Jim. And I know we've talked about this before, but before we get into the film, I want to mention my late friend Darcy O'Brien, who was the son of the cowboy actor George O'Brien and the actress Marguerite Churchill. And Darcy, at the end of his life, was in Tulsa for the last several years of his life, teaching at TU, and we became friends. And he told me, and it was bolstered by his book, A Way of Life Like Any Other, which was his first novel, and the title given him by the Irish poet Seamus Heaney. But in A Way of Life Like Any Other, the protagonist talks about going to his friend's house, and his friend's dad is a filmmaker, and they have a beach house. A swimming pool, a house by the swimming pool, the pool house, a cabana, where this man has all of the creations that of his movies on painted on the pool house wall, Jungle Jim being one of them. And Darcy said that was exactly the way it was. He was best friends with Sam Katzman's son growing up. And he would go over to the Katzman house, and by the pool there were these guys, you know, Jungle Jim, he mentioned, and I guess maybe Superman was up there too. Didn't Sam Katzman do some Superman?
Superman, Bela Lugosi.
Bela Lugosi, yeah.
I mean, Hattie McDaniel could have even
Could have been. That would have made for an interesting tableau. But he remembered Jungle Jim being painted on there. So obviously Jungle Sam was proud of his involvement with Jungle Jim, who of course came from the comic strip back in the 1930s.
Yeah. Well, his fellow executives in Hollywood, large and small companies, bestowed that nickname on him as kind of a disparaging thing. And he accepted it as a badge of honor.
Yes, absolutely. And Darcy also said that when he'd go over to eat dinner with the Katzmans, he said when he went over and sat down and they sat down for dinner, all they did was just scream at one another. It was not in malice, no malice whatsoever. They just hollered throughout dinner the whole time.
Sam was like that in person. He was pals with my uncle in the movie theater.
Oh, that's right. You and your uncle Grady. Yes.
Yes, exactly. And of course, Grady Wilson ran a mixture of theaters. There was a big old first run house. Then there was a B movie house. Then there was a kind of a foreign and art film house, all in that same community. And Grady couldn't wait to get the next Katzman. And Katzman used to come in person just to test the waters.
So how old were you when you met Sam Katzman? Do you recall?
Probably about 8, grade school age anyway. Mm-hmm. And we stayed close right on through the time I got into the newspaper business. Of course, my connection, not only was my uncle, but the fact that I worked for a number of very, first-generation Yiddish clothing merchants in that same downtown area. They were neighbors of my uncle's. My uncle and I were basically Shabbat goys. We assimilated culturally and economically. and Katzman was pals with some of the guys who ran these mercantile emporiums, thanks to their wartime experiences, their service in the war.
Well, it was probably a few years after that I met Johnny Weissmuller. As long as we're dropping names here, we might as well do it. There was a department store in Tulsa when I was growing up in the 60s called Ertley's. And Ertley's would bring in occasionally movie stars. They brought in Marilyn Maxwell, I remember, when the Lemon Drop Kid was on. And they brought in Johnny Weissmuller. And I recall that Johnny Weissmuller, and it was, you know, of course, it was those days when autographs were free and not $50 a pop. It's not to put too fine a point on what's going on today. But so I remember Johnny Weissmuller had a pink pad of paper stamped with his signature. And when we walked up, when we kids, of course, Jungle Jim was in syndication at that time, when we kids would walk up to talk to him, he was dressed like Jungle Jim, he would sign to John, and then it would already have his autograph stamped on it. He'd hand us that sheet of paper, and I remember him. It was very exciting to meet Jungle Jim because he was a pretty prepossessing guy. I mean, a very physically prepossessing guy. So let's talk about this Jungle Jim. And the film that we're doing, Jungle Jim and the Forbidden Land, which, as some people have suggested online and elsewhere, could be called Jungle Jim Meets the Werewolves. That's some amazing, and very well done, I think, makeup.
Oh yeah, when they went monstrous, they didn't pull any punches. I mean, the cheapness of the Jungle Gyms has more to do with basically stock footage.
Mm-hmm.
And
as we see with the Panther, for instance,
in this particular show. And of course, as a consequence of all that stock footage, you get some clashing ethnicities sometimes.
Yes, you certainly do.
some portions of the Third World don't look like other portions of the Third World.
That's exactly
right. And, of course, that really didn't matter because I don't think it was any contempt for the audience. I think it was just the assumption that, it's a bunch of kids, they'll never notice.
Right, yeah, they can get by with it, sure.
And so that very generously entertaining pictures and what a breakthrough in what today is known as cryptid cinema.
Would you explain that a little bit more?
Like Bigfoot pictures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hairy semi-human primates.
Mm-hmm.
You think of that trend as having begun, around early 70s and the Legend of Boggy Creek, but
with
the
Charles B. Pierce stuff, sure, yes.
Right, there pseudo documentaries. Have been such elements. I mean, there's the episode of Cimarron City in the late 50s that has the is he or isn't he an ape man at large near the small western town. Steve Bissett is writing a series of books about what he calls cryptid cinema. That is, movies about basically mysterious humanoid beings.
Okay, cryptid. That's interesting. So, that's an interesting term.
Not a term that I use fluently or routinely.
Right.
But it kind of fits in if you're looking for precedence of what is now considered a genre or a subgenre.
I see. Well, for the folks that haven't seen Jungle Jim and the Forbidden Land and want to know whether it's worth spending about, it's barely over 60 minutes. Jungle Jim actually has to deal with truth serum in this one, and he also deals with a beautiful doctor, Julie Benson, who is Angela Green, and horror fans know her from playing another doctor she's Linda Roberts in the Jungle Jim film, but in Night of the Blood Beast, she's Dr. Julie Benson. She's a female lead in Night of the Blood Beast with Ed Nelson and that whole Gene Corman bunch and Roger Corman bunch. And so she's actually played the two horror films she really was prominent in. She played doctors in both of them. But there is a land of the giants, and these folks really aren't giants. They're just sort of tall. But they're really weird looking, very werewolfian, not unlike what was it? Return of the Vampire that Lou Landers had done about that time for Columbia.
That would have been actually about a decade earlier, slightly under
That's
a decade
right. Of
earlier.
Of course, it would have been 40s. It's a
Nazi Buster vampire werewolf movie.
That's right, but they look a lot like Matt Willis's character, don't they?
They do, and go figure. That's the same makeup with variations, same studio, Columbia.
Yes.
That is the same werewolf makeup that appears in a Three Stooges short called Idle Rumors.
Oh, really?
Same werewolf makeup from Return of the Vampire.
Right.
And the same hairy face, kind of sneering, that shows up in, guess who, Sam Katzman's slightly later production of The Werewolf.
There you go. Right. Very good. Well, Jungle Jim knows where these people are, but he really doesn't want to give away the location because there's some people who are going to kill a bunch of elephants and get their ivory. There's plenty of story in this, actually. It's kind of funny how it works out. But then they give Jungle Jim truth serum. And he gets framed for a murder he didn't commit. And then he gets truth serumized and tells the people where the land of the giants is so they can go get the elephants, allegedly, and get the ivory. And, of course, then Jungle Jim saves the day. I don't think we need to add spoiler alert to any of that, do we?
No, you know, if a movie can be ruined by a so-called spoiler, then it's probably not worth watching.
That's probably true. You know, one of the things, Joey and I were watching this, and it was like, you know, at one point after Jungle Jim had dispatched about the third denizen of the jungle, he said, Jungle Jim kind of seems to hate the jungle. I mean, every time something turns up, he'll just kill it. And well, it's really true. And I know we're what, 70 years away, six, however long we are from that. And the things have changed because, you know, Martin and Osa Johnson, for instance, the celebrated big game hunters or Frank Buck, for that matter, would be looked at in a very different way now. And I suppose it's the same thing with Jungle Jim. It seems a little extreme that he just has to take his knife out and kills everything that crosses his path and disagrees with him. You know, including.
That's a lovely insight.
Well, it really is. And Joey says, why does a Jungle Jim like live somewhere else? Maybe get a nice suburban tract home or something. Because
he's under contract. You know?
Well,
I mean,
he is.
He's got a deal.
That's exactly right. But it is a horror film in a lot of ways because that's some scary makeup. And were these, explain to me and to the listeners, were bottom half of the double bills? What purpose did the Jungle Jims fulfill in Columbia's scheme of things?
They were self-contained star vehicles.
They were. Okay.
I rarely saw a Jungle Jim on a double bill, and if it was on a double bill, it would have been the top featured attraction.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was name brand. Weissmuller was bankable.
Yes.
He may not have been very versatile.
Right.
He might have been past his athletic prime, but he still, you know, he looked pretty tough in those khakis. And
he was granite hard in those things.
I mean, when we met him, I met him at a Montgomery Ward autograph party.
Right.
He was a stockholder, and Wards would put him on tour. Sometimes a local TV station would bring him in to promote the Jungle Jim films, so on and so forth. But I'm getting off the track.
Mm-hmm.
The presence of Johnny Weissmuller was still star quality.
Well, I can see that. Yeah, so it wasn't relegated like a lot of people have said, relegated to double bills at all then.
I'm sure it was in some situations, but I always saw them self-contained, sometimes with a backup feature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then by the early 1960s, couldn't wait for Saturday because about the time I'd get out of junior high school marching band practice, rush home, and it's time for Jungle Jim Theater, and never mind that you've seen these things before.
Right. And, of course, there was the half-hour series, too, around that same time, wasn't there?
Which was kind of a father knows best in the jungle.
It was. It absolutely was, yeah.
not particularly ruthless and always a wholesome moral lesson. But, hey, you know, I mean, the only bad Johnny Weissmuller is no Johnny
That's
Weissmuller.
That's true. You're absolutely right. And it's, are there other, I'm curious, this to me is the most horrific of the Jungle Jims. Are there others that carry this same sort of quality?
Oh, I would definitely add to that Killer Ape.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
From 1953, right about the same time,
mm-hmm.
with a genuine giant named Max Palmer,
mm-hmm.
As the title Killer Ape, which really doesn't look like an ape. It's more like a hairy giant, but not mm-hmm. a wolfman type.
Right, Right, just like these giants don't, I mean, these wolfmen don't look like giants. It's the same thing.
Exactly. So. They're just big and hairy.
Right, exactly. Well, we would like to, I think, recommend it because it's like, you know, it's 60 minutes. They got in and got out in a hurry. They're like, they're like the rock and rollers of the 1960s that were playing music for top 40 stations. I mean, they would just get right in and right out. Somebody like Paul Revere and the Raiders, they knew how to get in and out and deliver the goods.
That's right.
And that's exactly what these films do. And you could start, I think, at a worse place than this picture.
There has been off and on a, I'm sure it's an authorized boxed set of DVD Jungle Gems.
Mm-hmm.
I keep thinking, next time it shows up, I ought to grab it. But, you know, I've been taping and digitally recording those darn things off commercial television for years. And you can catch them in rotation on the Turner Classic Movies Network.
Oh, really? Are they at 3:30 a.m. or something, or are you?
I believe some of them were running like before lunchtime on Saturdays.
Oh, nice. Okay.
In fact, the Turner Classics Network ran the Universal Jungle Gems serial complete in its like chronological entirety just a few years ago.
And who was Jungle Jim in that?
Let me refresh myself.
Yeah, because I don't remember the name of that guy at all.
I do know, of course, and while we're waiting, the character's real name is Jungle Jim Bradley.
That's right. That's right. And started, wasn't he, a third panel in was it Flash Gordon or Tarzan?
That was the topper for Flash Gordon, topper for the Flash companion Gordon, feature.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Grant Withers.
Grant Withers, of course.
Whose name should be right on the tip of my tongue anyway, because I've been writing about him in a manuscript revision for the original Forgotten Horrors.
Well, he's no Johnny Weissmuller, Michael.
No. and the Universal Jungle Gym is no Sam Katzman.
No, I'm
sure it's better made, of course. but at the same time, a movie doesn't have to be impeccably well produced in order to convey entertainment value.
Right, that's exactly
and
right.
And sometimes it's like as we were remarking about the temperament of Weissmuller's Jungle Jim in these pictures, it's like he's kind of like Mr. Moto.
Mm-hmm. He's inscrutable.
He's really grouchy and impatient.
Yes, you're right. Absolutely.
Kind of like Peter Lorre. You know?
Yeah.
And of course, Peter Lorre hated playing Mr. Moto, so that doubled the intensity there. George Turner went to a Peter Lorre lecture in Chicago when George was in art school in the 40s, and they had a reception in the green room, and one of the ladies from the audience said, "Oh, Mr. Lorre, I remember every one of your Mr. Moto pictures." Lorre looks at her and says, "Then forget them." I don't think Weissmuller was quite that crabby about Jungle Jim because, you know, he made his public appearances in Jim's khaki, and you can tell that he may not love the jungle, but he was sure happy to be there.
That's
and Katzman,
right.
You know, it's like Katzman had Bela Lugosi under contract for Monogram Pictures before the Columbias.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, what a mensch. Just give him tell him he's a genius and give him a $5 cigar and he's happy. and so Sam knew how to catch a talent probably on the way down, maybe not on the way out,
mm-hmm.
but how to treat them with respect
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
as compensation for what was probably a reduced salary.
Right, and that's very, very important, and it was something that really Sam Sherman learned a generation later, wasn't it? And
mm-hmm.
the guys like that, and even Sam Arkoff and Jim Nicholson, when they were using, I say Jim Nicholson like I know him, James Nicholson, when they were using all of the old guys in the American International Pictures in secondary roles. You know, Jane Darwell and, you know, what was it, a reform school girl. I mean, you know, I think they must have known how to treat them. But in our book, which we'll talk about later, when they gave Buster Keaton all that work there toward the end of his life.
Yeah.
You know? Well, we want to talk, before we go into that, about our friend Craig Lamb, who has done a film called Dracula's Ghost. Now, Dracula's Ghost is for sale on eBay. You just have to look up Dracula's Ghost, and that's how Craig has chosen to sell it. But what he did, and Craig is a guy, Craig made Curse from the Mummy's Tomb years ago, when one of those horror movies that came up in the wake of Blood Cult here in Tulsa. And Craig knows his stuff. He knows his movies. He loves his movies. There's no doubt as to his intentions. And he decided that he was going to make a new Dracula picture using existing public domain footage. So he went and he dug into things like the Real Art reissue version of the trailer for Dracula. He dug into the Vampire Bat as actually forms the basis for this picture, as you know.
Right.
And he went back to that screen snapshots in 1933 that Bela Lugosi did, and all these different things. He painstakingly took elements from about six or seven different pictures and made what amounts to a Poverty Row new Dracula film called Dracula's Ghost. It's a labor of love. It is of a piece. I've watched it three times now, and each time I understand a little bit more about where he's coming from. It's, you know, he's got footage in there. Dracula never speaks. Lugosi never speaks. But it's clever and it's interesting. It's a very interesting picture in its way. And you've watched it, Michael. What's your take on it?
I think it's a very smooth edit. It the use of existing footage to create something virtually new.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are recognizable story arcs, most especially from The Vampire Bat, the 1933 picture.
Absolutely.
With Faye Ray and Lionel Atwell. But the insertion of the Lugosi elements and, of course, the generous existing use that The Vampire Bat made of Dwight Frye from Dracula, it makes it pretty seamless. It,
mm-hmm.
it honestly reminded me of some of the comic book, I hesitate to say mutilations, the comic book amendments that I've been doing with 1940s comic book stories and turning them into something new with basically new dialogue.
Yes, except that yours are pretty Dadaistic, Michael. I mean,
I'm not saying that
in a negative way at all, but you are certified to perpetuate existentialism in those.
Exactly.
Because you put the sticker on just about every one of them like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's, but of course, what the advantage that Craig has in working with, especially The Vampire Bat, is that it is a coherent and involving story arc, and the dialogue somehow fits his new situation.
It absolutely does. And what's interesting is when Lionel Atwell, who is the villain in the original Vampire Bat,
mm-hmm.
Lionel Atwell looks sort of suspicious and things. It's really just a red herring now. It's not,
right.
You know, and so he's been very clever in that way. I was very pleased and very entertained by it, and I believe it costs $20, and you can get it on eBay, and it's a new, I guess, you know, reimagining is such a tired term, but it's kind of a reimagining of Bela Lugosi as Dracula, and I just think it works really well, and he's having a lot of success with it. He's getting some great reviews, and I would really recommend it to people who love basically Poverty Row horror and the old horror, because Vampire Bat, as you know, was shot on the Universal set, rented Universal sets, right?
Right.
And
it looks like a Universal
picture.
It provides a new way to look at an old favorite.
It does indeed. And so, Craig, we're really glad that you did that. We hope there's more coming. And now, Let's talk about, first of all, your George Turner book. What can you tell us about that?
Oh, the new Forgotten Horrors spinoff. It's called The Monstrous Art of George E. Turner. And, of course, George was the original the founder of Forgotten Horrors. He was the one who came up with the idea and enlisted me to help him out, and we ended up with a full collaboration that has, you know, I mean, we're approaching next year the 40th anniversary of Forgotten Horrors.
My Lord, is that right?
Well, yeah. So there will be new titles galore to mark the anniversary. The first of them is this collection of, kind of apart from the film involvement, it's the artwork, often horrific, that George Turner produced from the time he was in college right up to the end of his life. And among other treats, it's got a complete authentic restoration of his dinosaur comic strip from the 1950s. It's got a very engaging newspaper article from the early 50s when George's old art school pal Gayon Wilson came to visit him. And a lovely portrait of H.P. Lovecraft that George did for an article I wrote back in the newspaper days. And, you know, what about, 200 some odd pages, I think it's 280 pages of George Turner's very often horrific and often very humorous artwork.
I remember running onto him when I was a kid. I say I was a kid. It was in the 60s. And I believe it was a Stuckey's or a Nickerson Farms, one of those places, one of those roadside attraction places. And they had little books. Well, they weren't quite pamphlets, but they weren't quite books, about outlaws and different things. And he had done several of those. And
Secrets of Billy the Kid.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And he was just all over the place. And he was he storyboarded Friends. Is that right? That was one of his credits?
That was George's last assignment on the long term. Of course, he had worked as a storyboarder ever since he moved out to Hollywood in 1978. He storyboarded Captain Marvel, Shazam, for Saturday morning TV, among other things. And a prolific, incessant sketcher and doodler. And so you find a lot of that. Before he did those outlaw books, there's one on Jesse James, one on Billy the Kid, and so forth. He had been one of the busier gag postcard artists.
Right.
And so if you ever run across a postcard that has a funny, somewhat risque gag on it, and it has the signature Tex on it, that's going to be George Turner.
Very good. And you've got some of those in the book, right?
Yeah.
I know you do.
Yes, we do. He was the one who came up with the old gag full of misspellings where the goofy-looking guy says, 6 months ago I couldn't even spell salesman, and now I are one.
That's right. And so And so
you know, I mean, I grew up reading George in the local newspaper. Grew up dining at little short order cafes with the family where his postcards were on sale, and somehow I recognized that Tex Lowell style as being identical to the George Turner style in the newspaper. And how'd you figure that out? I said, well, it's kind of hard to disguise, you know, it's like seeing an unsigned R. Crumb greeting card and recognizing it right off, because style will out.
Always will tell. That's right. Now, we also have a new book out that I want to plug that I'm really proud of, called Fantasies in the Sand. And Fantasies in the Sand just came out, well, at this recording just a couple of weeks ago. We're getting some robust sales already. And it's essentially a book about the beach party movies, but it's really a lot more than that, because we go clear back to the 40s and the sarong pictures, and of course that whole social fabric thing that happened with the war, and people who'd never been out of the States all of a sudden seeing the South Sea Island girls, and how that was really it's from Aquanetta, who was one of the sarong girls, to Annette. And that's what we've done in this, and I really think we got a good scald on it, Michael. I'm very proud.
Well, that's a book that probably wouldn't exist if it weren't for your intense interest. I had the theory. I had the I'd kind of proposed an arc. Let's look at the influence of what they used to call Guna Guna pictures, which were jungle travelogues.
Right, so to speak,
Of kind of a National Geographic style, and how that related to the same interests that had driven the novels of Herman Melville, Nordhoff and Hall, and certainly the tropical impressionistic paintings of Paul Gauguin.
Exactly.
You find that interest seething throughout the culture for a long period of time before it finally erupts in a very wholesome but maybe a little naughty way in the beach party pictures.
And well, the thing that's just genius about it is that you introduce it with an interview you did with Jim Boyd, who's a Western swing artist, he and his brother Bill Boyd were in Bill Boyd and the Cowboy Ramblers back in the 1930s, and they did a song called I Can't Tame Wild Women, But I Can Make Tame Women Wild.
Yeah.
And that was, as you put it, and how you set up the platform for the whole book, is that was inspired by, as you say, those Guna Guna pictures, the pictures with the quasi-documentary feel to them that talked about island life in Bora Bora and Tahiti and all of those places.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just, I think it was just a wonderful way to launch it. And, of course, we, you know, between the two of us, we've talked to a lot of folks about these pictures, from Sam Arkoff to Annette, to Frankie Avalon, to, Bobby Vinton. I talked to Bobby Vinton about his picture, Surf Party. And I really think it's a nice little volume. There's some insights I would like to think that you hadn't seen before, because I hadn't seen them before we started researching it.
There have been comprehensive books about the beach party pictures.
Yes, Thomas Lasante's
book is his definitive.
Yes,
I wouldn't profess to beat any of his time.
No, sir.
But I think our theories kind of enhance the overall effect of the existing scholarship.
We'd like to think they're complementary, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the other thing is, we would like to once again mention that we have had some downloads, and we appreciate that very much. Bill Boyce, Money Actor, our half-an-hour documentary that we did on our friend Bill Boyce, the star of The Slime People, is available on, and Joey, I keep forgetting that every time, it's available on Amazon Prime?
Streaming on Amazon.
Streaming on Amazon. Is that how we say that? Okay, thank you. It's available for streaming on Amazon. We'd like for you to take a look at it. It's pretty inexpensive, right? What do you know? It's 99 cents. What
99
is it?
Cents.
99
yes.
cents. For 99 yeah, cents, a half hour of Bill Boyce. Now, is there anything else that we need to plug before we call a halt to this prayer meeting?
Oh, man, the treadmill is churning, and we keep cranking out that stuff. More stuff, more new projects than we really know what to do with at one time. And that's a good way to be.
It is a good way to be. And I want to give a shout out to one of our listeners, one of our faithful listeners, Mitch Todd, who I talked to at Bill Bernhardt's Red Sneakers Writing Conference in Oklahoma City this week. And we just really appreciate it. We also want to say that if you have a picture that you would like for us to talk about, you would like to see dealt with here on the Forgotten Horrors podcast, please contact us on, Joey, what is it?
On the Facebook group.
On the Facebook group, Forgotten Horrors Podcast. It costs nothing to join the Facebook group. It costs nothing to listen to the podcast. That's right. It's all on the inside, folks.
Yeah.
But we would be glad to hear from people. We've got some ideas for the next few podcasts, but we would always like to hear from you, like we heard from Stephen Hafner, and down through the few years we've been doing this, and many others. So if you've got something you'd like for us to talk about, let us know. We'd be glad to give it a shot. And I think that's probably the all I've got to say. How about you, Michael?
I think we've covered it, and
sure
eager to
like
get
it.
Cracking on the next one.
Very good, and thank you all very much for listening. We'll be back with you in another month.
Thanks, Michael.
Ha 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 ha!